I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to an FDP special.
Speciale.
How's it going?
Mate, I'm buzzing for this one. Like, genuinely buzzing for this one.
Right. If he turns up and we run a successful podcast episode, I'll be buzzing for this one too and all, mate.
I'm sure he's going to turn up. I am very excited for it. I mean, people, if you're watching us on YouTube, you're probably going to recognise this guest. You may have seen him on Soccer Saturday doing some reports. You may have seen him on Sky Sports News doing some presenting. You may have seen him pretty much anywhere. You may have listened to him on the podcast that he has just started as well. But guys, we have Rob Jones joining us today. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Yeah, very good. Thank you very much for having me.
Absolute pleasure, mate. It's been, I mean, you've been kind of one of those guests where we've been like absolutely buzzing and looking forward to having someone from Sky Sports News come on. Journalist, reporter, presenter, everything that you
prepare to be thoroughly underwhelmed.
You heard it there first, guys, from the horse's mouth himself. Yeah. honestly, mate, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on. If you can just start with tell us a little bit about yourself for the listeners that who weirdly might not know you.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm one of those sort of lucky people who when I was growing up, sort of knew exactly what I wanted to do with my life, which was go into sports journalism. Sort of remember going round to my grandparents to stay when I was a kid, and they used to have Five Live on in the evening, and it had, you know, they used to have live games on as they do every midweek, and it was people like Alan Green and Mike Kingham and stuff like that back then. And I was like, this sounds like magical. Like, they're talking about the football, and I sort of imagine I'm there. And then when my parents moved house when I was, I don't know what it would have been, about 11 or 12. Eventually, after years of me pestering them, got Sky. And then you'd watch like Sky Sports News and see people like Dave Jones or Kelly Cates. And you're like, oh, this is cool. And then the same with things like Soccer Saturday, and particularly Jeff, who's an absolute hero of mine. So it was always like growing up, I was always very excited, or like I wanted to get into that sort of industry. And then through sort of years of working my way up and you know, starting with a couple of football clubs and going into like local telly with BBC and ITV, and then moving on to to mainly doing stuff for Sky. Here I am, I guess.
Happy days. Sounds amazing. And you, correct me if I'm wrong, you did a stint at Liverpool Football Club? Or are you still doing that as well?
Still do bits, yeah. Less than I used to. But still do bits and bobs for them, yeah.
Are you a Liverpool fan?
Yeah. I'm not, no.
Oh, who do you support?
It's a secret.
Okay.
Yeah, I like to try and... I think that the world of media is changing all the time in loads of different ways, really. But there's a real theme these days that, you know, a lot of people and people I work with are sort of quite happy for everyone to know who they support. I think if you looked on my social media for long enough and did a bit of detective work, I think you could probably work it out. But, I think the great... What I sort of take a bit of a compliment from is that of all the abuse I've had on social media over the years, it's like someone will be like, you're really pro Man United. Then someone else will be like, you're really anti Man United. Then someone else will be, you're anti Newcastle. Then I'm anti Arsenal. So I think it sort of shows that I do an okay job of being neutral on the telly. So it's a Premier League club. I try and sort of keep it. I'm assuming one of you is Arsenal. Ben,
We both are. Yeah, we're both Arsenal
fans.
I've got my Omri and Bergkamp signed shirts on the wall.
It's oh, nice.
Blur cause the, I'll be honest, my room's a tip in this office at the moment. So, hence why I blur it. But yeah, we're getting a bit of a shirt collection going as well, which is quite nice.
Yeah, it's cool. I've got a lot of that stuff in my house as well. Football stuff, cricket stuff, and I think if there ever a day comes when I get married, a lot of that stuff will be slung up in the attic quite quickly for sort of, you know, nice pictures of Central Park or something.
Just get a little corner in the house. That's what I've done. Just a little corner in the house and they're happy with that.
I've got a townhouse, so I've got like two flights of stairs, luckily. So the first flight is like a cricket staircase and there's like a couple of signed shirts and an Adam Gilchrist glove as well.
It's
really cool. That's this one of like a prized possession now, and that was from when I was a kid. Like my dad is he used to work at Edgbaston's like in security, like overseeing stewards and stuff. Me and my mates went one day and the test match finished, the Ashes test, where Gilchrist, I don't know if you remember how much you like cricket, but one where he played that like uppercut over the slips, got 100.
Yeah,
and we stood outside the Aussie dressing room for ages and you could see them through the glass and they're all doing their bits and bobs, and my dad was like, come on, we're going, and we just like held on, and he just came out with like two gloves, and one of the poor lads only got a thigh pad, but you know, he didn't like cricket as much as us. Found his glove, and we'll forever be grateful for it.
Oh, I can imagine. God, what a feeling that must be.
Yeah, it's cool. And when you're a kid, you know what it's like, you know, when you get, like you're talking about having signed stuff, you know what it's like when people sign stuff or you meet people who are heroes. And it's one of those weird things where in this industry, you become very immune to meeting people who are famous athletes of sport. And then every once in a while, you're like, sometimes it's when you don't expect it because you're not expecting to see them. You're like, oh my God, it's so-and-so.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was going to ask because Will and I, we've gone to sort of a couple of sort of evenings with ex-footballers and things like that. We've met Paul Merson. We did an evening up in London. Fantastic speaker. What a character. Obviously, I'm sure you know him quite well from Soccer Saturday and stuff as well. But I remember I bumped into Arsene Wenger and David Dean outside King's Cross. And it was like a boiling hot summer's day. And literally just strolling across the road and saw him. I was like, no, it can't be. And don't get me wrong, we're kind of average fans by comparison to like sort of everyone else, and you know, especially yourself, Rob. And just seeing it, as you said, you're always just in awe, thinking, "No, this can't be right." Arsene Wenger, what's he doing at St Pancras? Just standing around, talking to a police officer, like a police officer taking selfies. I was like, "I've got to ask. I've got to be that sort of thirsty person." So, excuse me, Arsene, can I have a selfie? Getting this cop like shoving in my phone, like, "Please take a picture." It's just fanboy.
Nothing wrong with that at all. Every once in a while, it's got to be done, I think. And like I said, that one of the reasons that you know, you go into it is because you love sport, and that sort of doesn't diminish for me. Like, there are still you know, obviously times when you're like, I'm tired or I don't want to drive to here or this game is appalling. But ultimately, you love sport and you love meeting people. And when you do meet people who are, you know, particularly, I think particularly when they're like your heroes growing up or something, then you're like, oh, this is something special.
Yeah.
Is there anyone in particular that's given you that feeling then?
The one that sticks out is Michael Owen, because as a kid, okay, you know, one of my earliest memories of understanding football to a certain extent and like the magnitude of games was the World Cup in 98, and that I think one of the, you know, the strongest feelings of a single match I've ever had was the Argentina game, where obviously like the amazing joy of Owen's goal, and then being absolutely distraught when Beckham got sent off and obviously England lost on penalties. So I think from that, you know, I think Michael Owen would be one. I'm trying to think of anyone else off the top of my head. We were pitch side at Edgbaston on the first day of the Ashes this summer, and we did a live in the morning with Kevin Peterson and Ricky Ponting together.
Wow.
And again, like, the 2005 Ashes is still one of the greatest sport, I don't know whether you'd call it it's not a tournament, you know, series or events I've ever
incredible
witnessed.
Incredible.
Yeah, and I just finished college. So it's one of those you had all summer, and every morning you would just get up, put it on, watch it for 10 hours because you had nothing else to do.
Yeah.
And yeah, so standing there with those two for like another test match and another Ashes series, I was like, this is a joke. Like, someone in the morning is going to go, what are you doing down there like with those two? Like, get out. Like, but it is fortunately your job. But yeah, I think there are a couple that would spring to mind.
Amazing. God, is it sort of a pinch yourself moment?
Yeah, which you have loads of all the time, and like I said, you need the dreary sort of League One 0-0s on a Tuesday night every once in a while to make you realise like how lucky you are for the great games or the great tournaments or events that you go to, because it's a wonderful job, and you know, it's all those crappy cliches about, you know, if you enjoy it, you never work a day in your life and all that sort of stuff. So that's still how it feels to me most of the time. So.
Fair enough. Totally understand.
Yeah, amazing. And so you're really into your cricket, aren't you? I think I've seen a few things that you've spoken about, and then today you've spoken about cricket quite a lot. Was you on Sky Sports News when England won the World Cup?
I was on in the evening, so
okay.
Yeah, so it was sort of a little bit after they won it. I was on Sky Sports News the day that Stokes played that amazing innings at Headingley, which was ridiculous. And it was funny because when you present as a two, I was on with Joe Wilson that day, who's one of my favourite people to work with, which is an absolute joy. But she's obviously Scottish, and we were sort of splitting the live sport. And she was like, oh, I got there and I was already sitting down and I was watching the cricket, and she was like, oh, you can do the cricket if you want. I was like, yeah. And you're just like watching it, and then we lost a couple of wickets, I think just like in our first hour or maybe just before we went on air, and I was like, well, this is gone. And then Stokes obviously starts teeing off, and like the newsroom, you can hear like everyone's like yelling while you're on air, and like, and we had, it was obviously August, but it's near the start of the football season, so like we had a guest on watching like the early Prem game as well, and they weren't watching whatever match it was by the end of it. They were watching Stokes, and we were watching Stokes, and everyone was watching Stokes. So it was ridiculous. And you go home and you're like absolutely wired, like you can't sleep. You're just like wide-eyed and just be like, that was amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, I can well imagine. And like with things like that, I can imagine it's just knowing that you've got like people watching you, and you've got to like kind of keep your cool at the same time as well. That must be hard.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things with telly, which I think probably I say to a lot of people, is you don't really ever think about the people watching you.
Okay.
And so you're really in the moment. But I think one of the most important things about sports TV, and maybe TV as a whole, actually, and I remember a guy I used to work with ITV, who very sadly passed away a couple of years ago, like way too young. But I remember having like a moment early in my career where I was like, oh, this was probably not great today. And he was like, yeah, but it's only telly. And it really stuck with me. It's like, yeah, we're not like, I'm not a nurse on the front line in the NHS doing 12 hours. I'm not, you know, saving people's lives. Like, and sport particularly is like that. So I think that whilst you are trying to keep your cool and you're not being an absolute super fan and you're obviously not swearing, but you're like, you need to convey the excitement to people. That's what it's all about, really. I think like, if you're excited, I think probably the people who are watching you are excited. And if you're not excited by that Ben Stokes innings or like loads of football games I've ever been at, then you're probably watching the wrong channel and doing the wrong job, to be honest.
Yeah. So can you just give us a little bit of insight into sort of the way it works at Sky Sports in terms of like the presenting and things? So just for average listeners, viewers, and probably myself and Will as well. So when you get this sort of breaking news, do you have that in your ear? Do you have to then prepare for it, or is it just like chucked up on the screen in front of you, like when it is breaking news and stuff? Like, how do you sort of deal with all of that all at the same time? Because I'm sure there's loads of stuff going on, isn't there?
Yeah, there is loads of stuff going on, and it's look, I think to do the job really, you know, like I said, you need to love it, and you need to you really ideally should have a good depth of knowledge of certain things. So, you know, you watch a lot of football and, you know, watch a lot of sport, and you really should be versed in certain things to a large extent. And some things you're obviously going to know more about than others. But, you know, I was on air just before Christmas, and it was, you know, you get a new earpiece, looks like Heckenbottom's about to get the sack. We'll do this after the break. You got 2 minutes. We'll do this. Wow. Get up to the big screen. We'll have breaking news in the background behind us. Heckenbottom on this. We're going to run in the goals from the weekend. We'll show you the bottom of the table. Do this, do that. And I think, luckily, I'd done a Sheffield United interview with Heckenbottom the week before. So I kind of remembered what fixtures they had. I just checked to have a look online. Again, like you're across things, so you remember that, you know, the first goal against Burnley that they lost 5-0, they'd scored after 20 seconds. So you'll just, and sometimes when it's breaking, they'll be like, right, this is breaking, we'll do it, and then we'll come back to it. And other times they're just like, right, we're going to sit on this. So like, I'm trying to think. There was a day where I was on, not quite when he got sacked, but certainly very soon after Solskjaer got sacked, and they were like, we're going to get a couple of the reporters on set, and we're away. Like, off you go. You got half an hour, probably. In fact, most of the afternoon we're going to be on this because the Man United manager just got sacked. So
you need
to know stuff, and the more you can throw into it, like obviously sometimes, you know, if a manager gets sacked, you get the club statement like copied onto your laptop and into your script. And, right, you know, there might be a time where you can't really say much more than that. And other times you can embellish and say, well, this is because they lost so-and-so at the weekend. This has happened. They've got loads of injuries. These are next fixtures, blah, blah, blah. And sometimes you sit with new presenters and they ask you questions about it, like you just said. And my advice is always like, don't try and be a hero. Like, if you don't know loads of stuff, don't sit there and try and like, and say, oh, I think he's this, or I think they did that. Like, if all you can do is read the statement out and say, we'll bring you more on this later, then do that. Like, yeah, you don't have to know everything about everything ever, but it helps if you know lots of stuff about it.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, it's one of those. I mean, I've watched Sky Sports. It's literally on every single day. Like, my other half absolutely despises watching it. It's on every morning, every evening. She's not a sports fan. She's like, do you have to watch it again? Podcast, no, luckily she's not on. She's next door. It's okay, bro. But it's one of those, like, I mean, I follow football pretty much my whole life. I'm into various sports. I don't know tons about it. I'm definitely just an average fan sort of thing. But you sort of see these things. And you always, like Soccer Saturday and things like that, how does it all work? Like, Jeff is just, you know, he was so quick with everything. And I appreciate these things obviously come over time, you know, as you said, you know, through experience and stuff. But it's just always quite fascinating how that all comes about.
Yeah, and I think like with live sport and stuff, we obviously prep it and have, you know, various notes. So like, well, I was on last night, It's really distracting, by the way, because Will's camera's frozen, so I've had the same image of Will for like 10
minutes. Oh,
sorry. yeah, so like, I was on last night and we had two football games, the FIFA awards and the NFL, one of the playoff games that had been rearranged. And I was on with Jess and we just said, oh, we'll split it. So, you know, I said, oh, I'll do the Derby game and the FIFA awards, and she wanted to do the AFCON game, and she knows more about NFL than me, so she did NFL. And again, that's like a thing of playing to your strengths. If you're on with someone else, like if you're on with someone who knows loads about X, leave them to it. So yeah, like I have a couple of pages of notes on all things Derby Burton, and then it comes to it, and you just, you know, they'll say, oh, Derby have scored, we're going to run the goal in, off you go, like so-and-so, this has happened, just going to show you the half-time shots, just talk over them for 20 seconds or whatever, and that's sort of how it works.
Perfect. Oh, that sounds fascinating. I love all this.
Yeah.
Love it.
Yes, yeah. And so, did you start at Liverpool FC TV? Is that where you first sort of made your break?
I don't know if I've ever made my break. I think I'm still waiting to make my break. I did a master's in sports broadcast journalism, and then I did some stuff on local radio. And then I got a job at Leicester, actually. And it was like a proper sort of bursting out of uni thing where you like write for the website, you do some interviews, but you like sort all the media's accreditation out for the weekend, you like allocate the car park. You're literally doing like everything, and you're working like super long days as well. And then I wasn't there so too long. Then I went to Everton, where it was a bit more sort of more journalism. Then I got a job at, I don't know if you remember, it was a local BBC show called Late Kickoff, and it covered the EFL club. It's sort of regional. So I got the job in Yorkshire to do it, and it was really brilliant, like really good season. And like it was Sheffield United, Huddersfield and Sheffield Wednesday were all going promotion from League One back then. Leeds were an absolute shambles. Chesterfield got to Wembley for something else. So that was good. Straight after that, they gave me a contract to do London 2012 as well, which was amazing. And during that period, a job came up in the Channel Islands for ITV. And I spoke to a producer at the time and said, look, what do you think about this? And she was like, you should go, because this is a great chance to go and get exposure, to go and make loads of mistakes, but to just get on telly whenever you want, really. You can be creative, you can try things, you can work out what doesn't work and what does. And then was there for 3 years, and it was brilliant, really. It got me, like, yeah, like I said, so much experience. And then eventually started doing like the sports bulletins on Sky News, and then did that for a couple of years and worked my way up really to doing stuff for Sky Sports News after that.
Amazing. Okay. Yeah. Sorry, Ben, I interrupted you a minute ago.
I was just going to move on to the sort of Soccer Saturday stuff. So you touched on it earlier, Rob. So do you get, also I'm assuming you get, you know, the games well in advance in terms of what ones you're going to attend. I'm assuming you get all the stats and stuff before the games as well.
You get a stats pack. Like, so, I mean, it's up to you as to whether you want to use just what we get sent, or you do your own bits and bobs of prep as well, which I like to do. Like, I'll try and watch or read the manager's pre-match presser or whatever it's been from both clubs, like look at the last couple of teams they've selected, just do a couple of other bits of bobs in terms of research of my own accord, as well as just take those stats. I think all of the information goes in a bit better if you do it yourself rather than you just be like, oh, here's a piece of paper. Yeah. So yeah, that's usually the way I work. I think probably if you've got like 10 different reporters on, they'd all say different things about how they do it.
Yeah, of course. And have you ever had an infamous cami moment at all?
Yeah. Well, I had one early in the season which I was really annoyed about, and it wasn't actually my fault. So I was doing Harrogate against Wrexham, because we have to cover every Wrexham game now, just in case Ryan Reynolds is there. But
yeah, I can imagine.
It's not quite true. So anyway, the goal went in, and usually have a lot in the Championship. You have a monitor usually with, and it's four cameras, and you get replays. So if you're not quite sure, you see it back. But with League One, League Two, the vast majority of times, it's one camera and you don't get replays. So ball goes in, free kick, header, guy scores. I'm like, oh, that's, I can't even remember who it was. Anthony O'Connor, I think it was. And then Harrogate Town, like on their tannoy, was like, oh, the goal scorer, number six, Warren Burrell, goes up on the big screen as well. And I was like, well, the club can't be wrong. Like, maybe I'm wrong. maybe I just didn't see them, but you know, their own tannoy is not going to go it wrong. Anyway, it turns out that I was actually right, and I'd sort of given the wrong goal score, and I was really annoyed about it. It's one of those things I was like driving back down the motorway, being like, Jesus, like, should have trusted my own. You know. And the worst thing was, it was a really cold night, and this is the magic of TV. Really cold night, and the battery on my camera got so cold that the feed cut, so I wasn't on again after I'd done the goal for 2-2. So I didn't even have the chance to say, look, a bit of a blah, 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 correct myself. So I was like, yeah, and going back down the motorway, so I was furious with Harrogate, furious with like, probably as close as I've ever come to one of those, I think.
So Harrogate's off the list of stadiums to go back to then, yeah?
Well, not off the list. No, knowing I've said that, I'll probably be sent there in the next 2 weeks. But
say, someone's going to be listening and they'll be like, all right.
Producer is listening, no more Harrogate.
What was the most memorable match then that you've ever sort of been to? What instantly springs to mind?
The Soccer Saturday.
But yeah. Well, anything you've been to, seen live or whatever.
There's two that would spring to mind straight away. One was Liverpool 4, Barcelona 0, which was just, you know, ridiculous. One of the most ridiculous things I've ever seen. And I remember pre-match, this is what it means about being like quite passe, but you're doing the pre-match, you're like, well, this is all a complete waste of time. Liverpool are 3-0 down here. Like, there's no way they're going to get through. Like, that was when away goals mattered for something. And obviously there was Messi. So there's all this sort of like, oh, well, Liverpool, famous European night at Anfield, blah, blah, blah. But they're not really going to win, are they? And then after six minutes, I think it was, Origi scored, and I remember looking at the floor manager and I was like, no way, they're like, they can't do this from here, there's no way. And obviously in the second half they came back, and it was just like so many great like storylines and subplots of the fact that they did it without Salah and Firmino that night. And obviously Origi is this ridiculous cult figure who sort of comes out of this cryogenic chamber, you know, in case of emergency, break glass with him on three, runs on, scores. And then you start him the following week against like Huddersfield at home, and you wouldn't know whether he was playing or not. And then like Merseyside derby on, he comes again. And all the while, there is also this amazing subplot. Like this guy Messi, whenever he picks up the ball, I've never known like a whole stadium be like, right,
yeah.
He picks up the ball on the halfway line. You're like, well, he could easily score from here because he's Lionel Messi. Like. So crazy. So there's the 4-0, there's the atmosphere, there's like watching Messi, one of the greats, if not the greatest player ever, certainly the best along with Ronaldo in our lifetime. All those things, that was ridiculous. And then the other one, and if you remember it from a couple of seasons ago, Bristol Rovers were playing on the final day of the League Two season, and they were fourth. They were level on points with Northampton. Northampton's goal difference was 5 better than theirs. So if, was it 6-5 or 6 better? Anyway, they needed to win, but they needed to win by 5 more goals than Northampton won by. And Northampton were like went 2-0 up really early on and won 3-1. But Bristol Rovers ended up winning 7-0. And I was there and it was absolutely ridiculous. Like, they were playing Scunthorpe, who were the bottom of the Football League and were absolutely appalling and had jacked it in for the season. And again, it's like, it was 2-0 at half-time. I was like, still got it. And then they scored within about 5 minutes of the second half kicking off. And I was like, this could well happen here because Bristol Rovers are like right at it. Scunthorpe have really packed it in and have packed it in probably quite some months ago. And yeah, 7-0 and just unbelievable scenes. So they would be two of the ones I could think of off the top of my head.
Yeah, I vaguely remember that Bristol game. Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
I can imagine. What was the scenes like there? Was the crowd kind of getting there from the start thinking we've got this, or were the crowd like you said with the Liverpool game?
It was weird. They did think it's obviously that old school, like proper last day of the season. Everyone's not listening to their radios, but checking their phones. And Northampton, I genuinely think Northampton were like 2-0 up inside some like 15 minutes. And I was like, oh, this is a bit of an anti-climax.
Yeah.
And then I think they were playing Barrow, and Barrow scored, so they pulled one back. But the more the second half went on, the more you thought this could happen. And then the seventh goal went in with about 5 minutes to go, and then they all ran onto the pitch, all the fans. So then the manager, Joey Barton, probably the less said about him the better, but like he's like on the tannoy being like, you need to get off the pitch, because if we don't finish this game, obviously we're not going to go up. So like they had to clear the pitch, and there was the weirdest thing ever of like, this amazing atmosphere where they're like, we're smashing them, Scunthorpe, we're going to go up. For like 5 minutes plus stoppage time, just completely lost their way. And like Scunthorpe had a couple of shots, and you were like, surely Scunthorpe aren't going to score. But it was like, they became so nervous because they'd like done it, obviously gone off. I assume like sat in the dressing room thinking about the fact that they'd nearly done it. And then were like so cagey for 5 minutes. And then obviously they won, so you go pitch side, and you know you're getting champagne poured all over you whilst you're trying to do interviews and stuff like that. Again, it's one of those where it's amazing to be part of, and you're absolutely like wired. And luckily one of my mates lived in Bristol, so I think we went out for a few drinks afterwards, but I was in like very good spirits, because again it's something to be like glad that you've been part of, really.
Yeah, it's a good night out Bristol as well.
It's a very good night out. Yeah, yeah. We went for the Women's Ashes there actually in the summer, and went to one, and we go to a game at Bristol every year, and always afterwards have a very very pleasant evening, let's say.
Yeah. I can imagine.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, guys. Make sure you're following us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter so you don't miss a thing. How could you? Instagram is at Football Drop Podcast. Twitter is at Football Drop Pod. Thanks, Will, for that. Or just search us on Facebook, Football Drop Podcast.
So, like, just turn our attention to like English football then. I'd be interested to sort of hear your thoughts on what's happening there in relation to Sheffield Wednesday and the ownership, Reading and the ownership, and then you've got the likes of Everton, the situation there in Forest and City. What, you know, with the financial fair play sort of stuff and the finances within it, do you think that's something that is a wider problem within football and will start to impact on more clubs?
Well, I think that Premier League clubs have been wary of this latest set of accounting, and therefore the two charges that came for Everton and Nottingham Forest. I get a sense that Premier League clubs might have thought, if we break FFP or profit and sustainability rules, you know, we'll get a bit of a slap on the wrist and a telling off and don't do it again, lads, you know. Mm-hmm. And then the fact that they've chucked 10 points at Everton this season has made everyone really sit up and think, we'd better sort ourselves out here and, you know, toe the line and, you know, obey the rules. And it's interesting that, you know, you mentioned like Reading, Sheffield Wednesday as well, that ultimately, I think a lot of these rules are there to stop things like that happening, to stop cowboys coming into football clubs and ruining them. And we should all really want that. Like, you know, I don't think, well, I don't, and I'm sure you guys who love football are the same. I don't want to see another Bury where they go out of existence, or another Macclesfield where they go out of existence. So if there are certain rules like that need to be in place, then so be it. And I sort of half take the argument of like Newcastle fans who say we've got Saudi owners who are the richest owners in the world who could spend more money but can't because of the rules. But the rules are the rules and everyone knows it. And, you know, I think if it's, you know where you are in advance, or everyone should know where they are in advance. And I know that one of Everton's arguments are, well, the Premier League said to us that the loan or part of the payments to do with the stadium, they understood that. And then that might have changed now. So I could sort of see a bit of frustration there. But it's like, with Forest, for example, you do think, like, sure, like, you've signed too many players. Like, I think everyone thought that. Again, I get the we sold Brennan Johnson a bit later so we could get more money for him on deadline day. But then it's like, did you not think to stop at like 30? Not don't think you need 43 new players. And the Premier League or the Independent Commission might well take Forrest's argument and say, yeah, you held on to get more money for Johnson, therefore that's a mitigating circumstance. So. It's not nice, is it? And I feel for Everton fans, I feel for Forest fans, because, you know, and certainly like poor Reading fans, Jesus, that just seems like an appalling situation. And you don't, you know, you, as a football fan, and you guys know you've had bleak, by Arsenal standards, bleak times, but you can sort of cop losing, but you don't want to sort of your club to be ruined from above the players and the manager, I guess.
No, I mean, we were literally talking about this, I think it was yesterday evening, so we did an episode yesterday, and we were sort of talking about, we can't imagine what it must be like, especially, as you said, you know, the Reading fans in particular, where they've protested, they know they're going to get fines and the club's going to get fined and things like that, but they don't care. They're doing it to protect the club in the long run. Yes, it's going to be a little bit of short-term pain from that, but this guy's already had two clubs go insolvent.
Yeah, I think in terms of they know they're going to get fines and stuff like that. I think, you know, I think like the pandemic really maybe taught us, I'm sure it's Bill Shankly quote or something like, you know, football is the most important of the unimportant things in the world. You know, it really doesn't actually matter, does it? Like, it's not, like I was saying earlier, it's not like we're all open heart surgeons. It's a game, but it's something that, you know, for some people, that 90 minutes you spend every 2 weeks at your home games is your salvation. It's your escape from maybe financial problems. It's your escape from, you know, maybe mental health issues or things in your life. And just watching your team and the special moments you have, like when you watch your team win, are a bit of relief and a bit of release. And to see someone who, you know, who looks certainly from the outside, like, I don't know Dai Young, but certainly Reading fans and the outside will say, this guy doesn't care about our football club that's existed for 120, 130 years. He's running us into the ground. And at the end of it, we'll probably go and walk away. And those poor Reading fans will be left thinking, what the hell do we do? Or do we start again as, I don't know, AFC Reading in the Isthmian South League, which is awful.
Yeah, certainly would be.
It's just happened so many times as well. That's the scary thing about it all. And as you said, you get these get these owners that just, you know, they just don't care. It's a business to them. They don't have any idea what the community impact it has on it. And as you said, you know, people's mental health, their livelihoods. You know, these people, as I can't remember who it was. I think it was Micah Richards said it on Rest His Football the other day, of these, like, the football players can go and get another club. You know, reasonably easy. Most of these players can get another club. But the dinner ladies, the groundsmen and things like that, that's their life. You know, it's normal people, as they say. It's very difficult to be able to just walk in and go get another job sometimes, especially when it's been there 20, 30 years. It's a whole different ball game.
100%. I mean, I think that is definitely true, that people, particularly if you're in a very, you know, skilled, specific thing like you are, a member of the ground staff, you know, that what do you do? I think you're going to get a job in a garden centre, or like try and get a job at a golf club or something like that. I don't know. And even with League One players, like, obviously we all hear of the astronomical fees that, you know, Erling Haaland or Mo Salah or Bukayo Saka gets paid. Like, if you miss a month's wages as a League One player, you maybe can't afford to do certain things, or you maybe can't fully pay your, you know, $1,000 or $2,000 a week. And I know, obviously, a lot of people would love to be on $1,500 a week, but, you know, it's not like League One players can just say, oh, don't bother paying us for 2 months and it'll be fine. Like, they have responsibilities and they have families as well. And yeah, like, to just be sort of so, I don't know, laissez-faire with the lives of so many people just doesn't seem right on a human level. Forget anything to do with, like, football and points and what division they're in. Like, that's just humanity of treating people properly.
Yeah, I agree. We can't get you on without talking about the most talked about thing. So you obviously cover lots and lots of different games in different leagues. VAR.
Love how you smirked.
Would you say?
Oh, good. I was taking for at least 20 minutes on VAR.
Oh, no, we've got 37, so it's fine. We're well over that.
what would you say is better? VAR?
Would you say it's better in, like, the lower leagues? So I mean, like, Ben talks about the Rest of His Football. I think Gary Lineker said that he prefers the football recently, you know, watching Leicester without VAR, he prefers it. Are you in that camp, or are you sort of still where I was a couple of weeks ago of, no, VAR can be good. I think it's needed. They can make it right. Or do you think it needs to go?
About 8 questions in one there, isn't
it? Yeah, like, sorry, I got excited.
Absolutely fine. Most people get there. Even my mum was sort of VAR and getting quite angry. The first question about, like, watching games in the EFL where it doesn't exist is that there is something quite refreshing. I was doing a game at Millwall between Christmas and New Year, and it finished 1-0 to Millwall. And you know, on the angles I had, it looked as though the goal was offside. And went down, did post-match, said to David Wagner, the Norwich manager, looks like the goal might be offside. And he was like, yeah, maybe. And that's it. And what else can he do? And I think there's something very old school about the fact that you could have a little bit of a moan about a decision, and that was it. And, you know, there's the old cliche of, oh, they all even themselves out over the course of a season. So, for me, the big problem with VAR is that you're using it to make subjective decisions. Mm-hmm. So, goal line technology is fine because that is what it is. Offside is fine because that is what it is. And we can all say, oh, he's only a little bit offside. The comparison I always make is to no balls in cricket. You may have only just overstepped, but you've still overstepped.
Yeah.
So, whereas a tackle or a handball, things of that nature are totally subjective. You know, the one at, I've done a couple of shows and a podcast since the game between Burnley and Luton on Friday night. I genuinely think, it, if not 50-50, probably 60-40, that 60 would say it is a foul, 40% would say it's not a foul. And that's the big problem with VAR, is that the way that Michael Oliver interprets a rule might be different to the way that Anthony Taylor interprets a rule, to the way that Jared Gillett, to the way that Peter Banks. And therefore, if you're getting one guy does it on field, then another guy decides that off in Stockley Park that he thinks differently. And all this is taking like 3 minutes.
Yeah.
To me, I think just stick with the on-field decision. Like, and, you know, if the referee has turned his back and someone's actually slammed into someone or elbowed them in the face or whatever, fine. Like, VAR can say, look, you need to send him off for that. But otherwise, I sort of just think we'd all be happier if they just stuck with the on-field, and you'd have a little bit of a moan afterwards about the decision that's been made. But, you know, you'd be over it.
Yeah. They're just sort of spreading the blame almost, I feel, with it. And I feel like the referees on the field... I don't know any referees. So I'd love to get a ref on the pod to kind of get their views as well. But it just feels as though they potentially can go, I'm not sure, so I'll wait for someone to correct me.
Yeah, and I think that it was really interesting. So obviously, you will know that Sky Sports News on a Monday, we have Dermot on. Dermot, the ref, yeah. And, you know, sometimes I present that show, and it's really interesting to chat with him. And I think one of the theories he has is that it does allow referees to sort of hedge their bets and wait to be told something. And the one I remember from this season, I don't know if you remember, the Merseyside derby at Anfield, and I was at that game, and Liverpool eventually get a penalty for a handball from Michael Keane. And Michael Keane's arm's like that. It's not one of these nonsense ones where it's like there. His arm is out. Like, everyone knows his arm's out. You think Craig Porson's got to see it, and you sort of think it feels like he's waiting for someone to say, I think that's handball, Greg, or the ball to go dead, the VAR to check it, and then he goes to the screen, then he changes his mind. And I think he could have made that decision on the field. It might have been, I don't know, and Craig Porson might tell me that he couldn't see through a player or whatever it might be, but you're right. It feels a bit like you're spreading the ball, like re-refereeing the game, I think is the phrase, isn't it? Someone in Stockley Park is overseeing someone else's work and doing a part of it.
So would you scrap it for now, or would you keep it?
I would go somewhere in the middle and say keep it for certain things, but not for others. So I don't know where I would draw the line, but there's that classic phrase that everyone uses, and they have clear and obvious errors. And I think that the bar for what people consider clear and obvious is too low.
Yeah.
We're looking and we're checking way too many things. Like I said, if it's clear and obvious that the referee's turned his back and X player's punched someone in the face and he's not seen it, sure, tell him and send him off. But like, certain penalties, and the other issue with it, this is just turning into a really long rant, isn't it?
Keep going.
Yeah, the other issue is like freeze framing stuff and slowing stuff down.
I agree.
You see, like, tackles and studs go like towards a camera like that, whereas, you know, in real time it's like, and it's gone.
Yeah,
and like slow it down, and someone inevitably will say to you in a press box, owner, doesn't look great, that. And it's like, well, no, if you slow down any tackle, like, most of them don't look great. And sometimes you're like, you're refereeing, you're almost calling a different incident because you're doing it so slowly. And you're like, sometimes, yeah. I was talking, we had Lee Hendry on with me on Sunday on Sky Sports News, and he'd been doing the championship game at Coventry. So I was given a penalty because the guy sort of cleared the ball, but he's followed through with his studs up and sort of caught someone on the leg. I'm like, you can't just stop your leg in midair. So where's someone's foot supposed to go once you've cleared the ball? You know, what are you supposed to do? So it's stuff like that where I just say, just leave it to the ref on field. And if it's something that the referee clearly hasn't seen or is like mind-bogglingly terrible, use the VAR. But I think you're using it too much, and you're killing parts of the game, and you're delaying the game for sometimes 4 minutes at a time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, have you had sort of much player feedback at all? Obviously, you don't have to mention names, of course, but because I know I've sort of caught some glimpses of interviews. I know a lot of the players are just saying, yeah, I sort of celebrate, but I'm not fully celebrating. I'm waiting just so you automatically look over to the monitor and stuff or the ref or whatever to kind of just say, can I celebrate? Did I score? Did I not score? Have you had much feedback sort of from your side and what their thoughts are?
I think that players, to a certain extent, would sort of echo what fans say, that they would love to hear and know more. And I don't think they feel they get a lot of communication whilst the check is ongoing. And sometimes if the ref could feed a bit more back, they would feel a bit more. And I think it's the same with, you know, getting it into the stadium somehow, like you do in rugby league or you do in cricket, that you can hear, say, oh, we've got to check for LBW, we've got to check for, you know, is it any reason why I can't award the try? And people sort of get the process, whereas it's this sort of like mythical land of Narnia in Stockley Park where you're like, well, what are they doing? So I think if the communication was clearer for everyone, and I think that to some extent that Mike Tuck show that Howard Webb does is helpful to an extent, because it at least answers some of our questions, if not all of them. But I think if everyone sort of knew what was going on a bit more, some people would like it a bit more. But I don't think everyone's going to like it, are they? And ultimately, if you're a player and a decision goes against you, you're going to think VAR's crap.
Yeah, naturally. I mean, you're always going to... I mean, fans, you know, if it goes against you, like the incident with the Ødegaard handball against Liverpool. I mean, we all know it was a handball. It should have been a penalty. How they didn't give it, I don't know. But us as Arsenal fans, we were lapping it up.
Fair play for admitting that. That's the thing, isn't it? That Ødegaard thing and the Calvert-Lewin red in the FA Cup recently.
Yeah.
Someone's checked that. Like, what are you looking at? How was that not a handball? Like, I think Dermot did a show on Boxing Day, which I didn't see because I was getting to a game, so I can't remember if there was an explanation as to why that might not have been given. But for everything I've been told by him, everything I've heard back from the PGMOL, like, it's all about the unnatural position of the arm. I mean, what? His arm is in an unnatural position.
It's out and it's on the floor.
Yeah,
playing basketball, wasn't he?
Yeah, and the same with the Calvert-Lewin thing. That, like, it's now been checked by a VAR and then overturned and rescinded like a week later. And you think,
yeah,
well, if that's the process, then we're in. And that's one of the other points that I would say is that people talk about VAR. The problem might well be that the officials aren't good enough. Like, it's not a great set of referees and VARs, you know, and I mentioned two earlier, Michael Oliver and Anthony Taylor, who I would say are the best two that we have. But clearly, there are some people who maybe are not of the calibre to be refereeing Premier League games, and therefore, that's where the errors come in from its user error. It's not necessarily a problem with the system, it's a problem with the people operating it.
Yeah, you hear a lot of the VAR is actually making referees worse now because they've got that, they're reliant on the VAR.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, you've got that comfort blanket of someone else sort of like checking your work, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So just to take us onto the Premier League then, with regards to Man City, do you think anyone can catch them, or do you think the title is theirs?
I think after his first season, I've been sort of incredibly unimaginative and tipped City for the title every season since then. And I mean, only one season have I been proved wrong, to be fair. So I'll take that. I think they are incredibly difficult to stop, aren't they? And, you know, the sight of Kevin De Bruyne sort of wandering back on and scoring and, you know, slinging balls in there. And obviously, you know, the goal freak is not far away from coming back either to butcher more defences. So, I think they're this is their thing, isn't it? That after Christmas, they sort of flex their muscles and say, let's... And I don't know whether you guys as Arsenal fans always thought last season at some point they're going to surge past us.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. we had a few weeks where obviously we was it 8 points clear, I think, at one point, if I remember rightly. And exactly. we did get a little bit excited. We was like, maybe we could do it. But we just know February time and April time, Arsenal falter every single time. Yeah. Might be a little slip. It might be a complete trip, but it happens every time. So we just both said, until we're lifting that trophy, we're not going to win it. We just pretend we're not going to win it.
You say that, but we did plan to go to the Open Tour bus.
Oh, absolutely. You've got to put the plans in place. But until we actually lift it, I won't, like we both said, we won't believe that will happen.
No, it's a funny thing that I think, and I don't know, remember watching the Amazon documentary, that the one team that he really, whether you go as far as to say fears, but certainly respects, is Klopp and Liverpool. That to me, feel as, and I love Arsenal. Like Bukayo Saka is one of my favourite players. Declan Rice, great bloke. I feel like Liverpool are the one. If anyone's going to hang in there with them, it's going to be Liverpool. And if they can get through, they've got three sort of sticky games where they got Bournemouth away on Sunday, Chelsea at home, which obviously, you know, looks harder than it probably is these days, and then Arsenal away, all without Salah. If they can get through that with 7 or 9 points, you think they're right in the mix. And as much as obviously the City have proved before that they can go on these runs of 11, 12, 13 wins in a row, so have Liverpool. Ultimately not this Liverpool, like Liverpool 2.0 as Klopp calls them, but you know, they've still got some players with that muscle mass, like Alisson, Trent, Virgil van Dijk, Andy Robertson, Salah, that have gone the course before. And I think that if Liverpool can't stick with them, they're away and gone again, aren't they?
Yeah. Unless, of course, Arsenal manage to sign a top-quality striker, then I think that might just change. I don't know if I'm just being optimistic, but I think that does change Arsenal.
Ben doesn't look convinced. Who do you want? Tony?
Tony, Osimhen, but I think they're both out. He signed a new contract with Napoli, and Tony's committed his definitely this season to Brentford, so I just don't know.
It's a weird thing, really, because the game isn't flush with them anymore, like proper out and out number nines. And we were chatting about it the other day at work. You know, obviously, Haaland is the best in the league. Then you'd probably make an argument that at the moment on form, like Ollie Watkins is number two. And then you are looking at people like Ivan Tony. But Ivan Tony, I think we're all sort of just assuming that he's just going to switch it back on.
Yeah, it's a big Saturday risk. Night
in Forest and be the Ivan Tony that we watched in the first season and a bit in the Premier League. Like, he might not. Like, he can't be match fit. I know he's been training, so it's different to being banned for other reasons. But you know, he might not. He might be a bit rusty for like a month. So it's weird because like City before Haaland arrived. Won the title a couple of years without really playing Aguero, without striker, with Jesus playing there or playing like Foden in that false position. You know, Liverpool won the title with Firmino, who wasn't prolific, like an unbelievable player, one of my favourite players to watch because he's one of the smartest footballers you'll ever see. Yeah. He wasn't prolific. So I think it felt to me, and I don't know what you guys would say, but like last season, everything went in, and like the conversion rate for people like Saka and Martinelli and Odegaard was really good. And if you sort of head back down to like a mean level, you're not as potent. And I think that feels like the problem.
I think that showed in the FA Cup game, didn't it, against Liverpool, where the amount of chances we had, we just couldn't put the ball in the back of the net.
Yeah, and I was at that game. It's really interesting because, you know, as I said, I think Saka and Martinelli came on, didn't he? But he had a bit of an impact when he came on. Those two guys are top players to me. But I'd be super interested to like hear your thoughts on the conundrum that is Kai Havertz, because he is. Oh, Ben, no, don't look. Because he makes some really good runs, and if you go to Chelsea, the press box is a lot lower at Chelsea, so you have a different view of the game. Okay. And I remember I did a game there last year, and I watched him, and I was like, he's really smart, but he can't finish. So you'll see, and you guys will see because you watch him every week, he gets in some great positions because he's smart, but he can't finish. So I don't know where his best position is.
For me, I think he is almost like a shadow striker playing just behind. He kind of reminds me of, it sounds really stupid, but I will explain. He's a bit of a crap Giroud. He can hold the ball up. Giroud had great positional play. He was always there, but he can link things up. You never thought of Giroud as a prolific striker. He was clinical at times, and he can score some beautiful goals, like scorpion kick against Crystal Palace.
A beautiful one as well.
Yeah. I mean, we're all just nodding, yeah. but I think if we have someone that is just an out-and-out striker, that'll get the best out of Havertz. You know, he's playing almost that sort of Xhaka role of last season, but he's not that player. He's got the presence about him, and he's got that grit and determination. He does, as you said, get himself good positions. He does press quite well, I've noticed as well. But yeah, you just can't have him face to face with goal. It just doesn't work.
No, and I think that I don't necessarily have a big problem with him playing as like a false nine. If you play like a false nine like him, you better be sure that your wide forwards are like, you know, vintage Salah and Mane and score you 20 goals each, because then you can get away with Havertz scoring 8 or 10. But if those two guys are getting you 12 and he's getting you 8, you're not scoring enough goals, and that's where you are at the moment. That's where you were with the West Ham game in the league. That's where you were with the game. Is that you're creating stuff and you look good, but if you can't finish it, I mean, not the most groundbreaking analysis in the world, but if you can't finish your chances, then you're probably not going to win a Premier League title, unfortunately.
No, I agree. I mean, that West Ham game that you mentioned, I've never been so annoyed at watching us play for years. I was so triggered watching it because, we had so many opportunities to just have a shot. And the only person that was actually doing anything of value at that point was Declan Rice. And he was actually having a bit of a pop shot, admittedly, but one just grazed over the bar. There's one that went a little bit wide. But we've got no one who wants to shoot first, pass second. All of our players want to pass first and shoot second. And I think that's the difference.
Which I actually think is sort of what Liverpool have really added like to their arsenal this year, is that they've got midfielders who love having a shot. Like Dominic Calvert-Lewin loves a shot. McAllister can shoot from distance. Curtis Jones has a shot. And like the old, again, it's just Liverpool 2.0, whatever. Like the old Liverpool, those midfielders were like workers, like Henderson, Wijnaldum. They ran, and they were so important to the team. But there's now like a little bit more cuteness and cleverness and goal threat from their midfield, which makes them really dangerous. That, you know, if you want to turn it into a you have a shot, we have a shot game against Liverpool, they'll probably beat you.
Yeah. It's just almost, I can't remember what game it was, a little just before Christmas, I think it was. It might have even been against us or one after. But they just felt like wave after wave of attack, and it was just Liverpool. I mean, at one point, they had 5-on-1 against us with Declan Rice.
Yeah.
Like, how Trent didn't score. I mean, I felt bad for Trent, for God's sake.
It takes a little bobble, doesn't it? And then
it's just that slight, wasn't it? Yeah.
I think he's a victim of the fact that his technique is absolutely outrageous. And he actually catches it just so clean. Like, if that had been Nunez, he probably would, like, scuffed it in. But because Trent strikes a ball, like, so well, he catches it absolutely flush, doesn't he? He slams against the bar, and actually that's what does him. And if it had been like a really like bungled finish into the ground, it would have got in.
Yeah, 100%.
But yeah, they've got goals from everywhere, and I think that I also think that probably being in the Europa League might help them. Is that if they want to sort of make 7 changes for a Europa League game, whereas if you're into the latter stage of the Champions League, like they usually are, you can't really afford to do that. So Klopp's obviously never won the Europa League. The final's in Dublin. It's set up beautifully for Liverpool to win it. But I think if it comes to a point, you know, in a semi-final game where there's a huge league game around the corner, I'd be really interested to sort of see what team he picked. If he saw the title there for a second time, I'd be super interested to see how he'd navigate his way through that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Too.
Really interesting.
Really good point. So thoughts on United at the moment?
Well, they're not very good, are they?
Not really.
No.
Don't sit on the fence at all, you know. Just say exactly what you feel.
I mean, I think you'd struggle to make an argument for them being good, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
They're such a funny fish because, like, the second half against Villa on Boxing Day, you're like, well, you're obviously all capable. And like, we all knew they were all capable. Like, Bruno Fernandes, individually, great player. Rashford, not been a great season, but really good player. Garnacho, super talented. But they don't do it regularly. And they remind me a little bit of something that Steven Gerrard said to me when he was the Villa manager. And they played a game and they hadn't scored. And I think they hadn't scored the previous games, you know, in front of goal, like, what do you need to do? He said, well, we're relying on one of our, you know, difference makers to create a bit of magic. And, you know, that was when they had Coutinho there and Buendia. And I remember thinking, that's not really how modern football... You look at City. City, we've all seen that goal where it goes from wide into a sort of eight inverted just on the edge of the box, back out wide, cut across the face of the six-yard box, someone scores at the back post. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not luck. They practice it until they're blue in the face, pardon the pun. And the same with Liverpool. Like, you'd see this, like, Roberto Firmino would come deep, clip it round the corner, Mane and Salah would be there, and the width came from Trent and Andy Robertson. Mm. So you need... And that's the thing with United, is it's like, where's the patterns of play? Where's... And they all seem... It all seems a bit of a hodgepodge of, like... And this is not an original point, but, like, someone like Antony, who cuts inside and wants to shoot, doesn't suit a big 6'3" centre forward. You know, someone like Højlund, to me, needs... And I mean, most forwards would say they need this, but like old school Beckham and Giggs, like, yeah, crossing it. Absolutely. And I think he'd score goals. And it's so weird because, like, they beat Villa. And I remember saying to someone in the office the next day, you can bet your bottom dollar that they'll stink the place out against Forest in 3 days' time. And they did. Like, just so predictable. And yeah, I also sort of don't think it's necessarily a massively quick fix. Like, I don't think that Jim Ratcliffe is going to come in and wave a magic wand and they're going to be great in 2 weeks' time or 3 weeks' time. Like, it needs, again, this is, you know, Gary Neville will bang this drum and rightly say, it needs football structure. And we did a podcast at Sky the other day with Steve Bruce. And I was saying to him, like, where's the smart signings? Where's those, like, you know, like a Salah or like a Julian Alvarez for City, or, you know, someone like a Martinelli or William Saliba. Like, you might not know who they are when they come in, but you damn sure know who they are now. Whereas it's always like, here's this big famous name like Casemiro, or Rafa Varane or Angel Di Maria or Ronaldo or whoever else it might be. It's like, okay, well, how does he fit with Scott McTominay and Christian Eriksen? Oh, well, he doesn't really, but he's good. Yeah, but that's not how team sport works. And that's the thing, isn't it? That, and I remember saying this like last year or the season before, two seasons ago, when they lost 5-0 to Liverpool at home. It's like they're a bit, and it's a bit like Chelsea, actually. They're not really a team, they're just a bunch of blokes. And because some of them are good at football, every once in a while, one of them will do something good with the football and therefore win them a game. Mm. But consistently, it doesn't work because it doesn't seem like... Identity is the word, and I know you won't like me saying this, but like Ange Ball, Spurs, you know what they're trying to do with it.
Oh, yeah, top quality.
Yeah.
And I mean, even with like Son's not there, or Basuma's not there, or Papsar's not there, and they're playing people like Skip, or Werner comes in, or Højbjerg comes in at the weekend, you still know what they're trying to do. And that's the fast... Like, Man United, I'm like, what are you trying to do here?
Yeah,
and actually, it sort of plays into their... It plays into their hands when they have to do something like they did at Liverpool, where it's like, well, we'll just be really structured here and try and hit them on the break because Liverpool are better than us and they got a decent point at Anfield.
Yeah, that's the thing. They do get a result like that and you think that's actually a good result. But for the Man United of old, they would be fuming with just a point. But it's a different generation. It's a different football club now, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think even if you listen to people like Roy Keane on Super Sunday and stuff, you know, a point at Anfield is very rarely regarded as like a bad result.
Mm-hmm.
When teams sort of make Man United like prod and probe and try and find a way through, I'm not necessarily sure they've got the answers at the moment. Mm-hmm. And to me, it would take an absolute miracle for them to get into the top four. I can't see it.
No, it's a wonder if they'll stick with Ten Hag as well, especially with if Ratcliffe, you know, does come in as we think he will, and whether he'll stick with him or think, actually, no, I want to take my own approach and appoint somebody else. I don't know who. You know.
Yeah, I think that's where you sort of need to know how Jim Ratcliffe sees it and what sort of manager he thinks they could get in. But, you know, I was really impressed with Ten Hag last year. Like, I thought he handled a lot of the situations really well. Like, I thought he dealt with the Ronaldo thing quite well. I thought, you know, initially he dealt with the Sancho thing pretty well. I thought that he obviously got the best out of Rashford. And that's one of the weird things is that they sort of made a big step forward and then this season it looks like they've gone backwards. And I know they've had injuries, but every Premier League club have had injuries.
Yeah.
I think with new owners, you know, we saw it at Chelsea, even with someone who was as good as Tuchel, new owners often want their own man and their own ideas. And it's... I wonder what Ten Hag would have to achieve between now and May to keep him in a job, whether if he was to get them in the top four and win the FA Cup, then he might keep the job. And if he doesn't, you would worry that they will look somewhere else.
Yeah. I'm really conscious of your time. I do have one more question, if that's all right. So just regarding the bottom of the table, really, is obviously you've got the points deduction.
You're not frozen anymore. Excellent.
I'm back. Oh, great. Yeah.
Has he been frozen the whole time?
He's been frozen for like 50 minutes, but you're back now.
Strange.
You can tell you're a pro at this. You just haven't even batted an eye. Yeah. Yep, just keep going.
with the points deduction and we don't know what's going to happen with that and Everton's appeal that's coming up, etc. What do you think the bottom of the table would look like? Because for me, it appears that the bottom three are kind of quite far away. I mean, Luton maybe not completely, but seem quite far away from sort of Everton, Nottingham Forest and the like.
I think Sheffield United are gone. Unfortunately, I can't see any way they're going to win enough games. Burnley, to me, the last two league games, really late penalty they conceded against Villa to lose the game.
Yeah.
On Friday night at home against one of their rivals, Luton. I really like Vincent Kompany. When we were talking earlier about people who sort of impress you, I remember doing a couple of championship games there and, you know, speaking to him as a manager. And he has an incredible aura about him of someone that I really respect and I really want him to do a good job. And it might well be that Burnley sort of go dice on him and allow them to get relegated and come back up again. And some of those players who are obviously talented will come again in two seasons' time. My dad is a massive Luton fan, and Rob Edwards is one of the nicest blokes ever. So I'm quite biased towards Luton. But they have a couple of things in their favour, and that they've gotten a really good habit of scoring late goals, which I think shows sort of character. And I mean, you guys will know that they gave you a great game, didn't they?
One of the most entertaining games I've seen for a long, long time.
Yeah, and it's horrible playing there. You know, it's horrible doing the Envisions there for Soccer Saturday because you're at one end of the ground behind like a pillar, so you can't really see everything. But They're a wonderful club, Luton, and but that they make it really tough to beat them. Like those big boys up front, Adebayo and Morris are a handful. They've got a bit of like Ross Barkley's playing out of his skin at the moment.
He is, yeah.
They've got, I think the goalkeeper is really good. So I think if it's going to be one of them who will get out of it, it will be Luton. I think Everton will have enough, depending on what might happen moving forward.
Of course.
The two I would worry about would be Brentford and Palace.
Okay.
Brentford, I think a lot depends on Tony, but even without Tony, and Bermo's injured for quite a while.
Yeah, true.
It sort of depends how long Wissa stays at the Africa Cup of Nations. But, I think a lot of it is dependent on how Tony looks when he comes back. And Palace just... there's always a team who sort of just drift into it and you're like, oh, well, Palace are fine because they've got Eze and Elise, but they just, and I don't know, they're one of those teams who sort of, and I'm conscious of saying this given that they're playing Arsenal next, so this could be the kiss of death. they just pick up like a random win from somewhere to get, every time you think, oh, Palace are wobbling, they'll win. Mm. But I don't know, like, I think it's going to be one from Luton, Palace or Brentford to join Burnley and Sheffield United, I would say.
Interesting. See, I with Brentford, I just really hope they don't go down. I don't know why. I think it's, I like them as a club, the way they're run. I think it's just one of them, it's just a success story. They've done it all properly. So it's one of those teams you think, yeah, I don't want you guys to go. It's nice having teams like that in the Prem.
Yeah, it's a nice ground. Thomas Frank is a really good guy. Like, really interested to speak to him. Him coming in and speaking to me the day after they got promoted. Actually, like, I think he'd had a couple of down the line in Burdocks the night before, but he was there and he was lively and good company. And yeah, they are. I've got a lot of players who I really like. Obviously, Tony being the main one, but. You know, a lot of underrated, like people like Ethan Pinnock, really good player. Henry, really good player. I would like to see them stay up, and I'd like to see Luton stay up, which I suppose by default means I wouldn't mind seeing Palace go down. But I don't have anything against Palace, but if Luton stay up, that is one of the great achievements. Like, depending on who won the league. Unless somehow Villa won the league, if Luton stay up, he's the manager of the season.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to disagree.
I completely agree.
It would be an unbelievable achievement. Like, I think when you look at, like, it's really interesting, actually. When we were talked earlier about Reading and Sheffield Wednesday, and obviously everyone knows the story about Luton, you know, going down, right down to the National League and stuff. And I remember speaking to someone at the club earlier in the season about transfers and people that they'd looked at who'd gone elsewhere, that they were like, well, we could get nowhere near that. And they're, you know, they say, look, we're not going to go down that route again of potentially like sliding down and having points deducted. And you've got to admire that amongst the people who are teams that are prepared to push FFP to the limit, you know, Luton are like, if we have to go down, we have to go down, but we're not. Again, it goes back to what I was saying earlier. We're not doing that to our fans. We're not prepared to sort of play roulette with the future of the club. But I think that is to be admired. And despite the fact they've hardly spent anything, they're giving it a bloody good go.
Yeah, they're riding that wave of this is fun. We like this. Let's keep going.
Yeah. which ultimately, like, it goes back to what I was saying, like, right in the start, like, football is fun and, like, you should be enjoying it. Like, you know, and when you're... Luton, it was probably, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, they were at Rochdale away on a Tuesday night, and now they're playing Arsenal and Man United and Liverpool and stuff. So, yeah.
Giving them a game as well.
Yeah, and giving them a proper game, yeah.
Exactly. But, yeah, I think we'll probably wrap up there because you're conscious of time. But it's been an absolute pleasure. And I'm sure you guys at home for listening, I'm sure you've all enjoyed it. But from both of us, Rob, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Very well.
Okay.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for listening to today's episode. Please give us 5 stars on your podcast provider, whatever one that may be, and help us hashtag drop the pod.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.